Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Mason, and I'm your host, Dale Graham. Thanks for joining us today. This is the 24th of August, believe it or not. And for those who are watching as the year progresses, the season is just amazing. And, you know, we live in a country here in Canada where it's always aspirational, or always aspiring to the next season. And we don't rationalize it, we just describe what we see. The summer is spectacular, although we can say, well, we'd like a little more warmth and things like that. But after all, everything's growing. Later by a couple of weeks, trout bothers the farmers. And, the swimmers, it's not as warm. They go out for a dip as it usually is. But then we're reminded at this time of the year about the fall coming. Fantastic. And then we think about all the things that happen around us and anticipate it. The fall fairs, the colors, the leaves change around here. It's truly magnificent when you see the maples all in scarlet and crimson and tones of crimson and yellows that are just and browns. It's just amazing. It's a wonderful palette, a demonstration of nature at its best. And then you're getting ready to dress for the weather. And anticipating the brightness of a sunny winter's day, where the snow is just fresh, and there's just something about it when you're the first one to walk in snow. And see, it's hard to not be poetic and inspired by what you see, if you let yourself enjoy it, of course. Today I'm going to talk to all of us about holding back, the difference between reaching our potential and holding back, the things that we do that used to be very conscious when we were little boys, the resentments and that pouty little attitude. Well, if we continue that on as adults, it really does distinguish us as less than what we would be proud to describe. Anyway, we'll talk about that in a little while, and we'll also have a little piece of mind. I'm going to let us in on something that I think is really quite interesting. We had nice comments last week. Thank you very much about the music selection. And this week, we're going to play a bit about a bit of music from Masonic composers. And then I always feel a little bit, oddly defensive, I guess. And I don't think I need to be, but when I'm playing the music, great music of composers, classical music that stood the test of time, it's nothing that I should be apologizing for. It just seems so odd to me that for so long, people of my background, I was born a farm boy, literally, in Prince Edward Island. I would never have had access to chamber music. Never. That was something for the gentry, not the likes of me. And here today, I can have access to the greatest music in the world ever written. And now it's a choice. When it's not there, when we don't have enough to nourish our souls and our minds and our bodies, then everything is important. Remember when we were in communities across this country that didn't have proper schools, then hiring that teacher was enormously important to the development of community life. And the brightest farmers and the early settlers all knew the importance of having their children well educated. And yet today there's an undecided indifference to it, isn't there? In some places. Some places around the world, they keep reminding us of just how important education is. And their children come here to take take advantage of just the very amazing educational system. And they make something of it. And I often hear malcontents sort of sitting back. The people who have lost that appetite, lost that hunger, who now take it all for granted and really will complain. Adults complaining on behalf of their children around things that are uniquely obscene in the school environment. The rights of their child. And the people that are teaching children arguing about I don't hear the discussions amongst them, of course, about the quality of issues and thinking and these experiments in education. All I hear is talk about contracts and wages and feuding with this business we call government. But you'll bear with me, I hope. Today we'll cross off a few lines in history, but I'm going to play for you a little piece. Something you don't want to do in the air too many times. The technical crew, I'm sure, will edit that out. The final release. Here's a little piece by Joseph Haydn.
Thank you.
That's a little piece from his piano sonata in E flat major. Why Haydn this morning? Well, I have hints that Joseph Haydn was a Freemason. Haydn was 24 years older than Mozart, and it is assumed that his sonatas must be earlier in style of music. He became a Freemason at the age of 53 on the 11th of February, 1785. The law, which he was a member, held the view that Freemasonry serves mankind in all parts of the world, under all kinds of governments, in public or in secret. It is believed that it was his friendship with the great one, Mozart, which brought about his interest in Freemasonry. We know that Mozart considered Haydn the greatest composer and his teacher until he was able to, you know, the bits that we have that come about Mozart, that he realized his own talent. But when you listen to Haydn, it's just for the likes of me, it's a transcending kind of an event. It was in this lodge that Mozart's father, Leopold, was a member. It was also a Freemason, Leopold Haschka, whose words were set to music by Haydn in the Götterhalt, also known as the German National Anthem. In 1791, he was in England performing various concerts, which included one at the Academy of Ancient Music at Freemasons Hall. At the end of the year, the sad news of Mozart's death reached him, and he wrote to a fellow Mason and banker, Johann Michael Puchsbachberg, "For some time I was beside myself about his death, and I could not believe that Providence would so soon claim the life of such an indispensable man." Mozart had died at the early age, weeks short of his 36th birthday, on the 15th of October, 1791. Haydn, on his return to Vienna, met a young musician named Ludwig von Beethoven, whom he invited to come to Austria and study with him. Therefore, Beethoven had two other persons closely connected with him who were also Freemasons: his doctor and biographer and his teacher. 1795, Haydn returned to England and left shortly after with a small libretto of an oratorio called The Creation, which was destined to become one of his greatest works. You may want to check that one out for yourself. The scholars believe that he carried with him a deep impression of his visit to Westminster Abbey, where the choir sang Handel's Messiah. And during the Hallelujah chorus, amazing, the congregation rose to their feet. This had a marked effect on him and created the desire to write such a work. The piece is by Handel and closely resembles that well-known piece. Masonry facing persecution both in Austria and France, Haydn set about to complete the script and had a great interest in Masonic works completed by Mozart, and it was and is still believed that the Creation is of the same nature as Der Zauberflöte. This piece is called The Miracle and relates to the beginning, and once again Masonic symbolism is caught up in it. Another composition which I would recommend for your listening, composed by this legend, is called Surprise. That's Brother Haydn. Amazing. 1732 to 1807. Yeah. We have a little bit to share. Truths. Truths are hard to hide, aren't they? Hard to hide. Plum rule, isn't it? Something about the plum rule and Jacob's ladder forming a line of union between heaven and earth. Truths are hard to hide. Has the library of Freemasonry become too large, too deep, too much? How old are we? 500 years, 298 years. Imagine the reaction you could get if you claimed your wine was 10,500 years old. Archaeologists may have found wine dating from the Stone Age, but it would be absurd to make such a statement. How old is the craft? It depends. Are you a student of theology, tracing commonalities between the major religions? Our gene pool is that diverse that it can be dissected literally or mined for the allegorical content. If you associate the process in Netherlands where constitutional practice was introduced, then we are thinking 15th century. If you are wrapping the craft into a world dialogue, then we are meaninglessly old. Are Freemasons expected to be students of science? If that's the case, religious fundamentalists would not do well at all. Funny, eh? How old are you? Does it matter? We're a curious lot. We worry far more than we ought. We carry on about trivial things. We don't find, and it's, we can't imagine, not doing that, can we? How in the world did we become so defensive about the workings of Freemasonry? Of course, in academic environment, it is like that. There's constant challenge to the rightness, correctness, and accuracy of idea. Somehow I thought that Freemasonry would have been a step beyond all of that. You know, when we're given our lessons early on to advance our Masonic knowledge every day, Masonic knowledge being the invitation for each one of us to define what that means intellectually. If it's history, so be it. If it's theology and religion, so be it. If it's physics, well, we're not quite taught about being a polyglot or the Renaissance man, but we're given that opportunity, aren't we, to have opinions about 18th and 17th century politics, about the history of thinking, about the roots of ideas. Here we have an opportunity to open the books and educate ourselves, one of the most powerful things any man can do. But too often those conversations and that set of simple instructions that provides the context for Masonic knowledge is forgotten. I think it's assumed. If we were in Lodge talking about this type of thing, you would get some people immediately feeling defensive. And it's so odd. Defensive about what? A process that's been going on for hundreds of years. The opinions and variations of millions of men. There's no need to apologize. You look around at the literature and you notice that we have a great many opinion pieces. And you'll find people close at hand with very strong opinions, hoping that they're right by saying them in a very forthright way. But you'll also hear wisdom. When you hear somebody speaking things in a very stern way, you can take it with a grain of salt, because if the idea has any merit, being stern doesn't matter to it. Or it could be offered in a quiet stutter, a nervous stutter. Still doesn't detract from the worth of what's being said. focus on the content of what's being said. That's your self-discipline that you bring to the table as a student of Freemasonry. So, as Professor Alexander Brody once taught me, my English professor in my undergraduate, he taught us all, the lovely, lovely old world type of English professor, that our work as students was to absorb, to listen, to open our minds. And he said very kindly, we really, as students, don't have anything to offer. You don't have the ideas worked out. You haven't read enough material in a particular field to be considered expert. And the world does not expect the student to be expert. We're there to be the student. When you graduate, then he said, that's your time. When you put your ideas together. Allow yourself then the opportunity to see yourself as the Masonic student. Receptive and open. Only you declare when you've done that enough. Just when you decide, you notice just when you think that you have the answers, then son of a gun, along comes another piece of information, a new piece of information that changes our ways of thinking, our way of thinking. It's wonderful. It's just wonderful. To be able to float on that chip of wood on this great ocean of ideas, and the direction is not something that's completely under our control. But we can be observant and mindful of what's happening around us, and should be, and should be. You know, it's... the cause of a lot of turmoil we bring on ourselves. It's not something we need to be proud of, about. But if you're ever feeling that, you know, you're hearing a fellow, one of the brethren in the lodge, enormously critical of other people, you know that the basic Masonic teachings have not really sunk in with this fellow. That he's not listening to himself yet. He hasn't learned that lesson. Well, give him a little bit of slack. Pythagoras, remember, taught his, when you came into his college, Collegia, you didn't talk for the first 2 years. Something that helped in my mind to bring this together was a quote from Socrates. We've spoken about Socrates previously. One thing I know, that I know nothing. This is the source of my wisdom. I'm not quite ready to say the latter, but one thing I do know, I say it in a different way. I live in a world of experts. Truly, everybody, especially Masons, are expert. They have better ideas. They're more right. So I think it's, as Epicurus said, we don't develop courage by being happy in relationships every day. We develop it by surviving difficult times and challenging adversity. So if these opinions and points of others are an adversity, you know, life is pretty good for me if that's all I've got going on. Nobody's trying to shoot at my family or change my way of life and dominate that. You know? Anyway, we're going to move on here today. That's and talk a bit about... we've got a little bit more music. We'll play a little bit by Ludwig von Beethoven, and wrap up with Jean Sibelius. Right, again, Freemasons. I never did finish with material on drinks that have beverages around the world that mark off certain points in time in our social and political history. Lovely talking to you. I'm just sitting here with a nice double espresso. It's wonderful. Nice way to greet you and sip on. I want to talk to you a little bit about coffee. You okay with that? You can work this into your Masonic conversation. Coffee is, Jean Michelet, he's a French historian, said, coffee, the sober drink, the mighty nourishment of the brain, which, unlike other spirits, heightens purity and lucidity. Coffee, which clears the clouds of the imagination and their gloomy weight, which illuminates the reality of things suddenly with a flash of truth. Well, yeah, it does give you that little lift. And North Americans are addicted to it. Yeah. The Greeks were fallible. Heavy objects do not fall faster than lighter ones. The earth is not the center of the universe. And the heart is not a furnace that heats the blood, but a pump that circulates it around the body. But only in the early 17th century, as astronomers and anatomists uncovered previously unseen worlds, did European thinkers seriously begin to challenge the old certainties of Greek philosophy. Pioneers such as Galileo Galilei in Italy and Francis Bacon in England rejected blind faith in ancient texts in favor of direct observation and experiment. There is no hope of any major increase in scientific knowledge by grafting or adding the new on top of the old, Bacon declared in his book, The New Logic, which he published in 1620. Our earliest, the thinkers that eventually came into the notion, were drawn to the notion of a fraternal collective, were reading this material. The restoration of the sciences must start from the bottom most foundation. Unless we prefer to go round in perpetual circles in a contemptibly slow rate. Bacon led the denunciation of the influence of the Greek philosophers. He and his followers wanted to demolish the edifice of human knowledge and rebuild it, one brick at a time, on solid new foundations. Everything should be challenged, nothing assumed. This is the basis of the world that we work in today. The way had been cleared by the religious wars of the Restoration, which reduced the authority of the church, particularly in Northern Europe. The new rationalism flourished in England and the Netherlands, driven in part by the challenges of exploiting and maintaining far-flung overseas colonies, and giving rise to the flurry of intellectual activity known as the Scientific Revolution. The spirit of rational inquiry spread into the mainstream of Western thought over the next two centuries, culminating in the movement called the Enlightenment. As the empirical, skeptical approach adopted by scientists was applied to philosophy, politics, religion, and commerce. During this age of reason, Western thinkers moved beyond the wisdom of the ancients and opened themselves to new ideas, pushing out the frontiers of knowledge beyond old world limits in an intellectual counterpoint to the graphic expansion of the age of exploration. Out went dogmatic reference for authority, whether philosophical, political, or religious. In came criticism, tolerance, and freedom of thought. I like these tools. I think we would do well if we kept them in our kit when we walked into the Masonic Lodge. But as you can see, the way that I think of a Masonic Lodge is a bit idealistic. I think of it as the place where the ideas that are told to us, the way it's supposed to be, isn't an approximation. That in the side of our lodge, we're to create as close as we can the perfection that we're taught is possible. The perfection of bringing a principle into reality. The principle of criticism, tolerance, and freedom of thought. But it's not abstract. It's not words on a page. It's a way of thinking that should influence the words that come out our mouths and the way we hear things. Criticism, not to deflate ego. Here's where we start to separate things out a bit. So, what is a lodge? Opportunity. What are brethren? The tools of that opportunity. To be students attempting to bring about the purity of the principles of Freemasonry, the perfection of equality in a lodge, of intellectual development. I don't think the vanity of the 20th century was in the minds of Masons or early ersatz philosophers. It wasn't that self-development meant slimming down to your 1% body fat. Listen, you know, these are all the artifacts of our contemporary environment. Do that get a six-pack abdomen, and you will cheat the Creator. You'll be able to live longer. We know that somebody that keeps their body and flexible and limber lives a good, better quality of life and sleeps better. We know that. Do a little bit of exercise. You're pouting about not sleeping well. Well, get off your ass. Do I need to apologize? No, I'm not your doctor. I'm your brother. Get off your ass, you lazy thing. You know you don't do enough. Oh, jeez. Hate it when those realities come into the conversation. We also know that you're going to be stunted if you let your mind turn to mush. Stunted. We have known forever that a well-educated man gets more out of the experience of life than an uneducated man. Get up on your hind legs and start thinking about formal education? Not at all. This is where the education, an educated man is able to teach himself. Not as a hackneyed kind of version of education, but to be able to realize that he can grasp the ideas of the greatest minds existing in our time. The difference that separates the men from the boys in that one is motivation. Do you want to? Do you need to? Well, this isn't a dress rehearsal. Life is the big stage. One act, like the Greek plays. Greek plays were put on, but you're thinking that you could go down to the theater, the Agora, every Friday evening with your mates and stand there and listen to a play. Not so. Some of them were only performed once. And the seats were what they were. If you were there late, fistfights would break out from latecomers trying to bully themselves into the audience. And it was chaos. It wasn't organized into this little version that we have today. Although I have to admit, I like things well organized myself. I'm a product of that. I understand how to wait in a line as they take my ticket, and I understand and appreciate it when an usher takes me to my seat. I love the fuss. It brings an importance to what's going to happen when the curtains open. Well, brethren, we've been given that opportunity. You've been ushered to your seat. The curtains are about to open. Maybe this play is on a theme relating to your life. Maybe it's relating to the life of somebody else from which we're expected to take away lessons, the allegory. Maybe the play is more, you know, my fascination with Shakespeare. Maybe it's more Midsummer Night's Dream, the allegories. Or maybe it is more historical, Henry III. But each play is conveying ideas, and we get to sit without the distraction of a room full of opinions. Remember that play is directed to the individuals in the seats, to the audience. So here's I promised you a little bit more music, but we need to know about another brother. So you'll take a little break here. Ludwig van Beethoven, although there are no definite Masonic record for Ludwig van Beethoven, he was born in, he was baptized, we know, the usual rule, 3 days after birth, December 17th, 1770. He passed away on the 26th of March in 1827, not that long ago. There were strong grounds for believing that he is a Mason. Of course, we want to. At the end of his life, we know that he was troubled. He was troubled by his inability to maintain a relationship. Many of his friends and fellow musicians were Masons, and there are several references to Masonry in his voluminous correspondence. The Adagio of Seventh Quartet, go and find the Seventh Quartet, Adagio, bears the superscription, "A weeping willow or an acacia over the grave of my brother." Both Beethoven's blood brothers were alive when this work was written, so these words probably had a Masonic connection. Schindler, one of his biographers, mentions a handshake when visiting the composer. "A grip of our hands said the rest." A song, "What is the Mason's Aim?" was written for the Lodge de Frères Courageux de Lorient de Bon and was published in 1806. His presence at concerts given with full Masonic rites is documented, and presumably in order to have been allowed to attend, he must have at least been initiated into the Brotherhood. Three of Beethoven's biographers state that he was a Mason, but none of them give any further information. However, during his early period, Masonry was oppressed in Central Europe, and most lodge records were either destroyed or not kept in the first place. Remember, even the tedium, you know, a lot of the secretaries can barely put down exactly, you know, fill out a form. They give no context about what was happening in the meeting. Nothing about the spirit of the meeting, the tensions of the meeting, and not a thing. It's just this sterile, the meeting opened at this time, this was the work, it closed at this time in due form. My goodness. Still today. To unstilt your mind today, join me, listen to this. This is something, you and I know this as the Moonlight Sonata. Beethoven's sonatas are just amazing. I think you'll like this. Gives us a little taste of one brother's efforts to achieve perfection.
Thank you.
That's Beethoven's sonata for piano, number 14, C sharp minor, opus 27, number 2, if you're curious about it. Not the music to, unless you have a well-trained mind, it's not the music to inspire, but it's music that draws us into a particular emotion, a way of thinking, a way of feeling. If we relax, our mind becomes sharper. This is the type of music that seems to do that, don't you think? Don't you think? It's like they, we'll carry on. We'll save Jean Sibelius for last. But I've thought that it's difficult not to be the Edit Apprentice. And I'm beginning to look at Freemasonry as a well of very cool, pure water. And beside that well, there's a dipper. And this reminds me of a cup that used to hang by in the barn in Prince Edward Island. And if you wanted a drink, you would turn on the tap in the barn. It's when you're outside in the fields and, you know, doing farm work when you're a little boy. It's wonderful. Running with your cousins. And the water was always so particularly cool, not painfully, but it was drawn from the wells. And I can remember it just tasted different. I can still remember that taste. That's, I guess, yeah, the limbic part of our brain is very powerful. All these senses are centered, very primitive. Taste and smell are very, very powerful statements. They can retrieve scenes in our minds from a long, long time ago. But this Masonic well is there for you and I. And we take the dipper and we slake our thirst by putting it into that water. So that's the well of knowledge for me. I hope that doesn't sound cheesy. It's not meant to be. I know I'm not the first to say that, think that way, but that it's, oh, there's a well of knowledge. But you slake your thirst, and I don't know how many sips it requires from you. Maybe you're not thirsty at all right now. The well is there, but you're not thirsty. Maybe you've been walking across that desert and you're parched and you're so thirsty that you're spilling the water on yourself as you keep drinking and drinking and drinking. That's a man that has a thirst for knowledge, huh? Well, I think that I sat and listened to myself, pondered that one for a bit, and I wondered if there's a time when my thirst is quenched enough. Is there a time when I'll have, there's not a time when there'll be enough knowledge. There's so many interesting things to learn. I'm fascinated by, right now, on a personal basis from Scottish history. It's just fascinating me. But I'm also, fascinated by Greek history right now. If you ask me today how much I know about the Peloponnesian Wars, I know next to nothing. I'm embarrassed to say. And French history, I'm going to save that for a couple of years. That's amazing. But at least I know what a Jacobite is. The history of Canada, it's being rewritten into more digestible form now. Thank goodness. It's a very vibrant history of a different type of nation. To think that it stands up to the richness and pomp and circumstance of early aristocracy, European and British aristocracy is naive. It's a naive thought. Even intellectually, we learn that, and we're going to do a program on this, that many of the ideas that were astounding and defining in Western thought were something that had been developed in Arab nations. Yeah, a much earlier stage. And now we have the privilege of being able to compare points in history when we see brilliant ideas from 5th, 4th, and 3rd century BC that are being developed with tools in the 20th and 21st century. So do we think that some of the mathematics, the decimal point and the introduction of zero, the concept of zero, do we think of that as a statement of an Arab a nation? It was. I'm going to talk to you about this most amazing effort by a caliph to produce, to bring together all the brightest minds and the greatest ideas in the world that existed at the time. About 4th century, if I'm not mistaken. And I'll talk to you about that later, but absolutely, from Masonic mind, this is like the well just became a little deeper and a little wider. The water just began to taste that much better. So as you dip into it, you ask yourself, what's enough? Well, you know that better isn't the final goal, I don't think. Better is a process of constant achievement. So today when you wake up, can you do it better? Well, it's like the wag that would always say, well, we could always work harder. Really? That's all you got? We could always polish that harder, more, brighter. Really? What a clever boy. Oh, but yeah, you know, you don't want to step on that. Well, that's a mother's milk statement. Anyway, I don't digress. I plunge in. I've been wondering if there's times when I need to savor it. I've drank enough, and I just need to experience, take that pause, like a step. Just a pause. I don't know what else, you know, whether it's digesting the ideas. I don't find the need for that clamor, and I certainly don't find the need for tasteless, ruthless competition. I find that embarrassing, pointless. I consider it bad manners. I like the intellectual smoothness that Masonry describes, that perfection, that Ashler, you know, I like that idea. So here, be that Mason, my brethren. You're not searching for it. You are it. That search for the perfection that the principles offer us can happen in a lodge, but there are all kinds of works and project and process. So to open up the minds of everybody, these types of notions need to be spoken out loud, because I believe in my mind, in my heart, that a lot of Masons are knocking on our door expecting to come into that atmosphere. I think that's, and what they see is that we don't get it. We don't get it. I know. You're saying, Dale, this is what was on your mind. It wasn't a whole lot on my mind when I walked through the door. I was, I'll be honest with you. I was taught the difference. I was taught the difference between what should be there and what wasn't. And then you're left to, and we're taught how to deal with that disappointment, that struggle that teaches us something. Just completely convince yourself that what's going on around you is a lesson. It's a lesson, and there's a point to it. And so I go back to myself still being the entered apprentice. In a little instruction, please. in his daily life, in home, business, and society, together with the realization of the fundamental unity of each with all, form the base upon which the aspiring candidate may rise a greater superstructure. In truth, he must live the life, the result of which is the purification of his body, so that the more attenuated forces of the higher degrees may express themselves through the finer sensitivity of the receiving pole within himself. When he reaches this stage in his growth, he is spiritually worthy to consider advancement into a higher degree. Maybe this is what I'm stumbling about. This advancement is not the result of election or ballot, but is an automatic process in which, having sensitized his consciousness by his life, he thereby attunes himself to the most succeeding plane of expression. All initiation is the result of adjustments of the evolving life to the physical, emotional, and mental planes of consciousness through which it passes. We may now consider the spiritual requirements of one who feels he would mystically correlate himself with the great spiritual fraternity which, concealed behind the exoteric rite, forms the living power of the Entered Apprentice Lodge. It is essential that the Entered Apprentice should have studied sufficiently the subject of anatomy to have at least a general idea of the physical body, for the entire degree is based upon the mystery of form. The human body is the highest manifestation of form which he is capable of analyzing. Consequently, he must devote himself to the study of his own being and its mysteries and complexities. Take care of your health is what he's saying to us. Get with the program. If you're going to live in this body, make it, tune it, do it right. We must move on and we must go. We must part company soon. Again, it's been great. I hope you'll come back. Jean Sibelius, brother Jean Sibelius, Finnish composer, composed music for each craft degree, and that music nowadays forms a vital part of our work in 3 degrees in Finland. Masonic music of Sibelius is known in profane world as Musique Religieuse, Opus 113, and has been recorded both in Finnish and English by Masons. The rights of these recordings and sheet music belong to the free and accepted Mason Suomi Lodge No. 1, in which Sibelius was a member. Essays and research about his work have been written, but only a couple of years old is the R.A. ritual music composed by Finnish composer, our right worshipful brother Pekka Koisimin. It was used within the Aldersgate ceremonies. So, shall we listen to a little bit of Sibelius as we part company for another day? Yeah, it's a very short piece, and this is Masonic Ritual Music 6, Processional, Onward Ye Peoples, Opus 113, Number 6. might try and work that one into a lodge meeting. What do you think? It's been great having you here. I hope this has been informative, a bit entertaining. Makes our brain itch just a little bit. I'll look forward to being with you again. Thanks for your support and kind words. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness and do take care of one another. Bye.